Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Svarim Chatter podcast. On this episode, I'm going to be joined by Professor Joanna Weinberg, and we'll be discussing Zaria de Rossi, otherwise known as Zaria Min HaAdumim, or otherwise known as Zaria de Rossi. I think that would be the proper way to refer to it. And his famous sefer, Ma'arei Na'im, and she has published a complete translation of it called The Light of the Eyes through Yale University Press. So with that, thank you, Professor Weinberg, for joining me.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for inviting me to speak on the podcast. It's a great honor.
Happy to have you. So why don't we start off, give the listeners maybe a bit of a brief biography, a little bit about yourself.
Okay, that's fine. I studied at University College London for my undergraduate studies, and that was in classics, in Greek and Latin. At the same time, I attended lectures and classes in the Hebrew department. And at the same time, on the same corridor in University College, was the ancient history department. And there was Professor Arnaldo Momigliano, one of the greatest ancient historians of the last century. And in the last months or the last period of my undergraduate studies, I was introduced to Zaria de Rossi by a friend, and I became very intrigued by it. And I suddenly thought this would be a good topic for my doctorate. In those days, you could go straight from undergraduate studies to doctoral studies without doing a master's. And although I knew very little about it, I was intrigued by it. It somehow connected with my passion for Greek and Latin and for rabbinic world. And so I made my way, and in a very brash way, I stopped Professor Momigliano in the street and I said, I need to talk to you about De Rossi. Now, Arnaldo Momigliano was a great scholar, an Italian Jewish scholar who had to leave Italy in the fascist era, came to England and basically made his life in England. He also taught in Chicago and in Pisa, but mainly in England. And he was the most influential historian of his time, but he was also a very proud Italian Jew. Italian Jews are very proud of their Jewish legacy. And when I said that I wanted to study Zaria de Rossi, he took me under his wing. He encouraged me and he supported me. He said, yes, you must go and do it. You must go and translate it and work on de Rossi. So that's indeed what I did. And I started my graduate studies at the Warburg Institute, an important, still today, important institute for the in the survival and transmission of classical culture. And after that, I went to do my research in Italy. And so it was there I began to breathe in the world that Zaria had breathed in. And it was there that I made one of my a big discovery, something which helped me to understand the last years of his life, and a new book that he had written at the end of his life. So it was a very productive time, a very important period for me in my scholarship. And then on my return, I completed my doctorate and I taught rabbinics and medieval texts at Lierbeck College. And then afterwards at Oxford University, where I taught rabbinics and medieval and early modern Jewish culture until I retired a couple of years ago. So that's really where I am. And De Rossi, therefore, was part of my life for quite a big chunk, let's say.
So why don't we start off, I think, about De Rossi, giving a biography of who he was, because some of the listeners, as famous as he is, may not be familiar with him.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So first of all, the biography of De Rossi, that's fine. Well, he was born probably in 1511. Remember that we know very little about De Rossi, unfortunately. Most of the biographical knowledge we have comes from his own statements in his own works. And so we have very little external documentation, but he was born in Mantua, and like Italian Jews and like other Jews of other places, he was very proud of being a Mantuan. Mantua is in northern Italy, in Lombardy. And of course, in Italian, it's Mantova, So in they used to make a kind of joke with it, with the name, and called it Mintova. So very, very proud of their city. And of course, I don't know if you've ever been to Mantua, but it's a pearl. It's a beautiful, beautiful city. So he was born in Mantua, and we don't know how long he was there for, but I think for a considerable time of his youth. And it was there that he clearly read a lot. We know that he was a scholar. We have a copy book from when he was 20 years old, where he's reading all kinds of things that he would never have dreamt of approving of in his later age, which is what happens to many of us, I think. So he was reading astrological treatises in Hebrew. He was looking at the alphabet to Ben Sira, which is quite a naughty piece of work. He looked at poetry, medical tracts. It's probable that he was trained as a physician. And we know, because we know that at the age of 35, he met the converso Amatus Lusitanus, a converso from Portugal, who was a famous physician, who wrote up his his patient's notes, as it were, and they were published and they were very much read. And in this, he has a whole long description of De Rossi. And De Rossi came to him because he met him probably in Ferrara, and where he found a De Rossi that was full of ailments and suffering and couldn't sleep, all the usual. He gave him a cure, but it's very interesting. You have a glimpse into Italian Jews, what kind of food they ate. And he gave him a cure. He told him to avoid the marshy areas of Mantua and Ferrara, because it's bad for his health. And in the end, he followed his cure. And he says that in 3 months' time, he became as strong as a boxer. Well, let's hope that that's true. But anyway, so we know that for certain. And according to Lusitanus, he was both a doctor and he taught. We know nothing more than that. And then we find him in Bologna. We know he also tells us that he was a censor of Hebrew books. Remember, in after 1554, there's a censorship of Hebrew books from Rome. And you have what's called, even before that, internal censorship, where Jews were making sure that the books that they wanted to have published would be acceptable to papal regulation. And it seems that he acted like that. And for a time he was in Bologna, where he was at the University of Bologna. And there we know he attended a mathematics class. And then probably as a result of the worsening situations for Jews in Bologna at that time, it belonged to the papal realm. And in 1569, Jews were expelled from Bologna. He, like many other Jews, went to Ferrara. And Ferrara was, like Mantua, a very vibrant Jewish community with various Jewish communities, I would say in the plural, because you have your Italian Jews. Remember that De Rossi prides himself of, and there are many, many Italian Jews who all pride themselves of being, you know, the scion that goes back to Titus, one of the four families that Titus brought from Jerusalem to Rome. They all say that. It's a bit like people saying that they come from, they're an heir of Russia or something like that. It's the same idea. They all somehow come from that same source. And so that's what he says. And in Ferrara, he lived for the rest of his life, we think. It's there he lived with in a vibrant Jewish community. They had an academia, they had a yeshiva. And of course, it's a time in which there's a lot of study. You don't have so many copies of Talmud about, because there'd been the burning of the Talmud in 1553, which affected the amount of circulation of Talmud. But they still were accessible. So, but it's interesting that he talks about studying Alfasi and other texts in that academia that they had. And it's it's in the last years of his life, and he obviously was a known scholar. He was a great scholar, and so he was known also in the Christian world. And in that Christian world, they desired to convert him. You know, it was very often that he was a big catch to get somebody of that great knowledge. And while I was in Rome, as I said, I discovered not only and a text that he wrote in Italian at the end of his life, but also this document from the Inquisitor of Ferrara, which says that he had tried in vain to convert De Rossi, but that De Rossi was not said that he wasn't a fanatical Jew who was incapable of speaking good of other religions, which is true. And one of the things about De Rossi is that he was a very discreet writer. He knew how to appeal to everybody in a sense, and he was able to. He was tactful, but he also, I think, generally believed that, you know, there was room for other religions, and he was able to speak in that way. And at the same time, though, he was dedicated to his own Jewish tradition. And I think that's a very important point to make, even at this point in our discussion, because, you know, there's a bit of controversy that hangs over De Rossi. But at the same time, we should remember that he remained a pious Jew to the end of his life. And that in questions of observance and so on, he was like any other Italian religious Jew of the time. I think I've covered most things. What's quite funny, we have few glimpses. The Inquisitor says he was extremely ugly, but very intelligent. So you've got these kind of little elements in which he's sort of, you know, something of De Rossi comes out. He seems a kind of Socrates kind of figure. Yes, I think we've covered most, and we think that he died in 1577. We don't know where he was buried, possibly in Bantua. We know that there was discovered a kind of a matseva in a wall, in which he is praised along with one of his colleagues, David Provenzale, as an upstanding Jew and rabbi. And I think that's important to remember that was discovered. So although with all the controversy that hovers over him, he was an upstanding Jew.
So I think one other thing I want to just ask you, I know we're going to get more to this when we get to the controversy, but what was his, do we know any of his relationship with other Italian rabbis, either in Ferrara or in the neighboring cities?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is clear that he was together with all kinds of important rabbis in this kind of academia that they had, with David Provenzale, Giuda Moscato, and I will be coming to it, but and with them, they were studying together. They were studying not only Jewish sources, but also Greek sources, Latin sources. And that I can prove by comments he makes about the way they were studying the great, most important Jewish historian, Flavius Josephus. And they were reading all his works, which were in Latin translation, freely available. And together with also, I don't know if you've heard of Giuda Moscato. Giuda Moscato is he was his friend, and also a man, he came from Osimo, but he lived most of his life in Mantua. And he wrote a commentary on the Kuzari, on Yuda Levi Kuzari, and also sermons in the Futsot Yehuda, which are amazing texts, as complicated as De Rossi, but of course very different. But with the same polymathic knowledge. So what you see in Moscato is what you see in De Rossi, an enormously wide knowledge of rabbinics and medieval Jewish commentators, but also Kabbalistic texts, but also of Latin authors, of all kinds of descriptions. And that is, say, the hallmark of these Jews who were studying. When you are a physician, I forgot to say that as a physician in Italy, and there were Jews who were physicians and attended the university in order to get their training, you had to be able to know Latin. So these were people who were basically trilingual. They knew their Hebrew sources and Aramaic sources, and they knew their Latin and Italian. And that's that means that they were fully rounded scholars.
Yeah, I was going to mention that the Yehuda Moscato would probably be the one most familiar to people because of Nefusis Yehuda, and also on Kuzri. I think it's Kol Yehuda. That's still around.
Kol Yehuda.
Yeah.
And this is very important. And maybe I can. It's a bit out of our chronology of what we're doing, but I think it's quite. It will perhaps make sense to you that. One of the things all of them were studying. Now, let me go back before I talk about Moscato. Let me talk also about David Provenzali, because the Provenzali brothers were also involved in De Rossi and what was happening with the book. And David Provenzali and his son Abraham were going to set up a kind of Jewish high school so that Jews could go and study not only Torah, Bichtav, and Torah Shebaal Peh, but also Latin, and that they should learn Hebrew grammar and Hebrew rhetoric and Latin, so that they were able to study in a kind of Jewish school. And it's comparable to what the Jesuits of the time were doing, later on were doing. It's very, very interesting. So David Provenzali, he was actually Mantuan, and his brothers, they were all of the same type, namely open to the culture around them, and at the same time very much deeply engaged with their own rabbinic sources. And now the thing with Moscato and also with Provenzali is that they work together with De Rossi, as it were, studying the works of Philo. Now, I told you that I was interested, I started as a classicist, and I was interested in particular in the Hellenistic world and the Greco-Roman world of which the rabbis were part. And my interest was always in the way those two worlds came together and how the impact on each other, because there was exchange. It wasn't always conflict, but also exchange. There is, there's no one world which is cut off from another. And that, in a sense, that drew me also to De Rossi, with all the differences and the world then. And what is, of course, important for those who study 16th century or 15th century Italy is, of course, the interest in recovering works of antiquity. Now, Philo wrote in Greek, but Philo of Alexandria was a Greek Jew living in Alexandria in the first century. And he wrote in Greek, but he wrote kind of exegesis of particularly of the Chumash, he used a lot of allegory. He was a very, very but at the same time he was a Platonist, a kind of middle Platonist, and he uses a lot of philosophical vocabulary. So he combined biblical exegesis with Greek philosophy in order to come up with some very important interpretations of scripture and discourses altogether. He was also a representative of the Jewish community that went to Rome when Caligula wanted to put up an idol in the temple. So an important figure. Now, because he wrote in Greek, and possibly also because he was an author that was read very much by Christians, Jews forgot about Philo. He wasn't known. They just went into complete dissuasion. Nobody knew about him. And then in the 16th century, when Latin translations of Philo were appearing, you have Jews like Provenzali, Moscato, and De Rossi reading Philo. And this is very important, because what they're doing is saying, we have a history there's a history out there, an ancient history. How does it belong to us? Who is this Philo the Jew who is writing exegesis of Tanakh? Who is this man? What does he mean to us? Now, it's very interesting. De Rossi was a historian. So he tries to go and set Philo in his historical context. He sets out to understand Philo. What kind of Jew was he then? When you read his work, he looks a bit suspicious. He doesn't seem to, what he says in his discussions of bits of laws, it doesn't sort of seem to fit with what we know as rabbinic law. But yet there are aspects of him that do fit. And so who is he? What kind of Jew is he? And in the end, he sort of sits on the fence and says, this man, we don't know who he is. We'll just call him Yedidya Alexandri. Yedidya is a kind of Hebrew form of Philo, the Alexandrian. So very careful, very discreet. And what is so interesting is De Rossi is very careful and sort of says he's a kind of sectarian. He's not exactly a rabbinic Jew, but he's a good man. But, you know, I don't know. I can't really deal with him. Whereas Provenzali and Moscato go out on a limb to say he's a rabbi. He is Rabbi Yedidya. And what happens with Moscato, if you read the Nefutzot Yehuda and the Kol Yehuda, I've just written an article on this, actually. Philo is absolutely a good rabbinic Jew whose work and whose ideas are comparable to Ramban, to the rabbis, and he's put side by side with them. Not only that, David Provenzali, and I've just found it, De Rossi talks about it tonight, and it's in manuscript in Budapest. De Rossi, Provenzali writes a critique of De Rossi on Philo and says, how dare he say that he's suspect? He's actually a good, upstanding Rabbi Yedidya, and no way. And it's a long, long critique of De Rossi's critique. So this gives you some idea of how complex this world is. And it's a world of discovery. And it's the world, they're curious. They want to know and they want to understand and they're open. And the openness is extraordinary where, in a way, unhistorically, Moscato and Provenzali want to make Philo into a kind of Jew. It's a bit anachronistic, like Hillel and Shammai, where, of course, he's miles away from that world. Whereas De Rossi is very careful, says, I'm not sure about him. But let me put him, I'm a historian, let me see what kind of person he is. And so that critique of Philo that he makes is in that first section of the Ma'ori Naim. And I say it now, I've taken it a bit out of context because you asked me the question about how he worked with other rabbis of the time, and this is the way they worked. So it's that scholarly exchange. You don't necessarily agree with each other, but you are both intent on understanding your own history. And I think that's what's so important. And setting the record right, especially in De Rossi's case. Yeah. Right.
Okay, great. And for people that don't know, Philo also sometimes referred to as Philoin in Hebrew, maybe they've seen that. I did want to mention two other things going back on what you mentioned before. First of all, another famous rabbi people may know of that also wrote in Latin and spoke Latin and was a doctor when university was the Sfarno, Rav Avdia Sfarno, who wrote his Or Amim. He translated into fully in Latin. We have, I think, his doctorate. He went to university. So he was a doctor as well as a famous I'm Chomish. And then also, I did want to mention the Provenzalo. Reb David is not so well known anymore, but his brother, Reb Moshe Provenzalo, was actually, we have his volume of Shalos HaTshuvos was published by Mechon Yerushalayim, so that he has some famous Tshuvos in there. That's he was a brother of his, right?
That's right. Yeah, no, absolutely. Very important. Sforno, of course, is earlier. He's in the first part of the 16th century. And but he's it is very interesting that he translates his Oramim into Latin, the Lumen Gentium, and he dedicates it to Henry II. It's an extraordinarily interesting work. And what is also interesting about Sforno is that he... is that he's also a teacher of Christians. He teaches the famous Hebraeus Johannes Reuchlin. So you've got many fascinating individuals in this period who are connected with the scholarly world around them. I mean, you've got examples of also the Kabbalist Yohanan Alemano, who works with Pico della Mirandola, also Elie del Medigo. So it's a very vibrant world and a world of exchange. And I think one of the most mysterious and colorful characters in this time is Elijah Levita, also called Bocher or Elia Bocher, who is a German Jew, though comes to Italy, he's a grammarian and a Masoretic, and a Yiddish poet, a very good one, a very skillful poet and grammarian. And he teaches Cardinal Egidio da Viterbo in Rome. So a Catholic, he's teaching a Catholic. Then he works in the printing press and he edits books, his own books and other books, and he's a scribe. Then he goes back to Germany and he works with a reformed, a Protestant theologian, Paulus Fagius. And there he also prints his own books. And then he goes back to Venice and he dies there and he gets buried in the Jewish cemetery on the Lido. So it's an amazing world, life in which he goes from one sort of very context, which is very different to the other, and comes back still fully fledged Jew. And I think that's very important to remember. So these people were absorbing the scholar, as people always did over the centuries. You just have to think of Rambam. But I think we haven't talked about the earthquake, which is, of course, supposedly the main event. But you tell me where you'd like to go now.
Yeah, so I think we covered, I think, a lot of the setting of Italian Jewry and for De Rossi. So I think we should go talk about the earthquake, but in three, it comes kind of converges everything at once. So it's the last part of De Rossi's biography that we haven't discussed is the earthquake in Ferrara. And also that will go right into Ma'ari Naim and the structure of the book as well and his inspiration for the book, so he says. So why don't you talk about that?
Okay, all right. So I think the most vivid part of the book, I think you'll agree with me, the part which is most readable, because this is not an easy book to read, however good your Hebrew is, however scholarly you are, it's difficult. But the most readable part of it and the gripping account is his description of the earthquake which hit Ferrara in 1570. And this, of course, affected not only Jews living in Ferrara, but the whole community. You had people fleeing the city. Alfonso d'Este, who was the ruler of Ferrara at the time, leaving Ferrara in a hurry. This description that De Rossi has is so vivid, and he talks about how they had to do what happened to them when the miracles that happened. For instance, the 10 synagogues, the 10 shuls that remained standing despite the earthquake, and this was a miracle. How his wife's went green and yellow because of the earthquake, and then she had lots of salt, and then all kinds of stories. But among the stories are, of course, that they had to flee their homes and that they were living under canvas in tents. And he talks about, of course, you know, this was, there were Sephardim there, as we said before, and they were actually the wealthy members of the community. It's interesting. And they opened their big courtyards to people so that they could sleep there. And it was when, according to De Rossi, when he was were living there in sort of in the outside under canvas, that he met a Christian who asked him something about the letter of Aristeas and wanted to know what the reading was in Hebrew. Now, the letter of Aristeas, and De Rossi said, well, there is no Hebrew translation of this text. Now, the letter of Aristeas is the famous description of how the Bible got translated into Greek. And according to the text of the letter of Aristeas, it was a courtier in the court of Ptolemy Philadelphus in the fourth century, who wanted to make sure that there was every book, you know, the famous Library of Alexandria, that they had every book and they knew about the Torah of the Jews, and they wanted that translated and brought to Alexandria. And so the story is that he goes to Jerusalem, meets the high priest Eleazar, and 70 elders are sent back to Alexandria and they translate the Bible into Greek. It's an amazing story and amazing description of Jerusalem and the temple and the priests. And it's actually a beautiful text, a very difficult text. And it's an important text because this then gives rise to, it gets embellished the story such that in the end, you've got these 70 elders sitting in different places and they are all coming up with the same rendering. And elements of the story gets into the Talmud. So in Tractate Megillah, in Masachet Megillah, you have the description of the translation and how they made five changes in order not to offend Ptolemy Philadelphus. And it's quite interesting. And then there is a later revision of the attitude towards the Greek translation, which said 3 days of darkness came to the world when the Bible was translated into Greek. So the story of the translation of the Bible into Greek is something that is known and filters through also to the rabbis, and there's both a positive and a negative reception, let's say, of the story. So the story, though, is important. It's very long. It's called a letter, but it's much more than a letter. When the elders come, they have to ask, they have to answer all kinds of questions. It's a fascinating work. That is a key in a way to understanding something about first, because it is in a way a forgery. I mean, it was not written by Aristeas. It's now quite clear that it was written by Jews living in Greece to actually defend the Greek translation of the Torah. And so it is a very important document, but of course it's also an important document because it's the Greek translation which gets used later on by the church. So there are all kinds of dimensions, historical dimensions to this. So De Rossi though says, when he said I should, so I decided to translate it and I translated it and then I finished the rest of my book in this very short time. He translated it in a few days and then the rest of the book. So it's unlikely that, you know, the book was something it took him a year and a half or something, but it's not a year and a half. And who knows, I perfectly accept that he met a Christian who asked him about that and then he undertook the translation. But the book is clearly the fruits of a lifetime's scholarship. It's not done quickly. It's a remarkable book. Let me go back to really the elements of the book so we have a clear overview of what it consists of. So basically it's in three parts. The first part is De Rossi's own translation of the letter of Aristeas into Hebrew with a commentary, where he makes use of the sources that are relevant. So Josephus and the church father Eusebius, a church historian Eusebius, and other people, but basically a lot of Josephus. Then there's this beautiful description of the earthquake. And then there is the third section called Imre Bina, which is divided up into 60 chapters or four sections. And what is amazing is that this work has a structure. I mean, it's been called essays, made up of essays, but these are not just essays because they are interlinking, and there's sometimes a closer connection than others, but certainly they're all connected. And this, the main part of the book is a set of historiographical questions. De Rossi is setting out, and I think the main phrase one should use with De Rossi is one that he uses over and over again. He says, the beautiful soul seeks to know the truth of everything. And he uses that phrase particularly when he is going into a subject and bringing evidence of things that might be difficult to swallow. But that phrase is terribly important. The beautiful soul wants to know the truth of everything. And that's really, in a way, the key to the work. It's a work, though, in which he has to be both apologetic and offensive at the same time. He is aware that he is going to tread on toes, and of course, as we know, he did tread on toes. At the same time, he can easily be misunderstood. So it begins, though, with chapters which are about, is it better to study just one thing fully or to use lots of sources? And then he talks about, is it permitted to use non-Jewish sources? And he provides all the evidence and fact that, you know, great people did use non-Jewish sources, and that's de rigueur. And then after that, he sets out the section on Philo, and then the section on why the Greek Bible is divergent from the Hebrew Bible. And there he comes up again, this is a topic that is of interest not only to Jews but also to Christians. You have to realize that he is mediator. He's a mediator between two worlds of scholarship of the time, the Jewish one and the Christian one. The one who's interested in, everybody wants to know what is the correct rendering of the biblical text. And what does that Hebrew word mean? Why is it different in the Greek? Why is it different in the Targum or whatever? So there's a desire to know what is correct. So the understanding of why the Greek is different from the Hebrew was also important. And according to De Rossi, in a very novel thesis, he says, because the language of the people at the time was Aramaic, and they were translating from one of the Aramaic versions. This is totally unlikely, but nevertheless, it was a novel thesis in order to try and understand why these divergences. From there, he goes into various historical questions. Remember, he is a historian. And although there have been chroniclers before him, there's never been a work written like this, which is what one would call a historical critical examination of rabbinic sources. And it is as a historian and as a critic that he looks at rabbinic texts. And then, so in the second section of his book, he comes to discuss, among other things, the nature of the Agadot. And this is one of the key areas of controversy. But remember that he wasn't a complete innovator of that time. Already in Gaonic period, you've got people like Hai and Sharira saying, you know, that it's not supposed to be taken literally, the agadot, they mean something else. When it says God cries, it's not that God is actually crying. There are all kinds of different approaches to the agadot through the centuries. But De Rossi comes along and he's saying something similar, but he's using different language. He's coming as a historian and in a way as a physician, a kind of scientist, and he's saying, and also as a literary person, he's saying, you know, you have to understand the idea of metaphor and that these agadot are meant to stimulate you to the virtues, they mean to move you. That's what agadah, that's what that word means actually. So that's part of what he's doing when he describes the agadot, but also he's looking at it and he's really preparing people for his chronological thesis, which is one in the part three, because for instance, one of the agadot or one of the non-legal statements he discusses there is the statement that Darius was the same as Cyrus, was the same as Artaxerxes. One of these statements in the rabbinic text, which sort of, you know, they make the three into one. And this is like Pinchas is Eliyahu, all those kind of statements where people get merged into one and the same person. And of course, there is a reason for that. And De Rossi, though, is keen to explain to his readers that it's impossible, that historically speaking, it is impossible that Darius is the same as Cyrus, is the same as Artaxerxes. They are different individuals, but obviously there is a different reason for wanting to merge the three into the same persona. So, and in that same section, I think it's important to talk about is chapter 19, which is a chapter about textual criticism and about what happens to texts as they get transmitted. So that he's talking about transmission of texts and about how you know, a text like the Zohar, which he seems to accept the attribution to Shimon Bar Yochai, you know, it's tampered with because there are clearly references to Amoraim, and that's not possible because Shimon Bar Yochai was a Tana. So he's again here, this is a very important thing that you have to be on the lookout for tampering with texts. And he does this the same with the Jewish Josephus, the Yossipon, the Hebrew text of Josephus, a medieval text, where clearly if you think it's written by the first century Josephus, then there's a problem because it talks about events that are long after his life. So this is again is telling you what kind of textual critic De Rossi is. He's not completely iconoclastic. He's not sort of destroying things. He's trying to explain what happens when you got things in your text which don't add up, and he doesn't want false reconciliations. He's not a pilpulist, I might say. He doesn't sort of harmonize or reconcile things in order just to reconcile, even though the evidence doesn't lend itself to. He's coming as a historian and a scientist to try and understand what happens. We'll come back to one of his interpretations of Agadot when we talk about the Maharal of Prague. And we'll go on then to the third section, which is of course the longest, the most complex in a sense, quite tedious in some places, according to the great scholar Roberto Bonfil. It's completely boring. Who would want to read it? But you have to realize that in the 16th century, lots of tomes of this kind were being written with figures and years and chronicling kings and rulers. Oh, you want to say something?
I wanted to go back. First of all, I think originally when you said, I wanted to just clarify, you originally said that the first part of the book is about the Aristeus and then it's about the earthquake. I think it's the other way, right? First he talks about the earthquake, then he talks about the letter of Aristeus, if I remember.
Oh, sorry. Yes, I did. I've forgotten the thing, but I've actually, yeah. First, of course, the earthquake, which is the reason for the book, and then his translation. I apologize. Yeah, of course. Thank you.
Perfect. Just clarifying that. So that's one. Second of all, I got it. Like you said, it's different, but there's a famous work that actually I have a friend who edited, did a podcast with him about Rabbi Rambam. And Rambam has a book, the Rambam's son has a book on Agada also, and it's also the Gaonim, like you said, the Gaonim have their own opinion. So different than Derossi, but similar, but we'll get there by the morale. So I think, like you said, we should move on to the other part. The bigger part of the controversy and the real Chayrim and everything that happened was on the year. So without, like you said, without boring people, just to give a quick synopsis of what in the world he was talking about and what
he was
what
talking about there. Yeah, well, I'll try and make it in a nutshell, really, because he says, you know, there's a problem with three periods in Jewish history. One is about the Exodus from Egypt and how you calculate that. One is, and the second and third, more important, the length of the First Temple, the duration of the First Temple, and the duration of the Second Temple. And connected with this, and very inextricably connected with it, is, of course, the calendar. And I think, in a word, one might say that for him, both the years that are counted and that are generally used are what he would call convention, as opposed to reflecting any reality. So just as much as the fixed calendar we think, you know, came into being in the time of Hillel the Second, there was the fixed calendar with the Dichiot and all of that, meaning that the calendar that we have doesn't go back to Yetzirah or indeed to Baharad, or that all of those very complicated computations are computations that in the end are not Torah Misinai and are dependent on a kind of the sense that the rabbis were aware what they're doing. They're making something conventional era so that everybody abides by it, but that it is not actually the correct year. And he shows in great detail, using all kinds of different sources, how it's impossible and that, in fact, the world must be at least 100 years older than we think it is. I don't know what he would have thought had he lived in our own time and was familiar with Darwin, and I don't know what his position would be, but he's on the right track. And namely, in the end, what you get is what is an interesting, a very gentle sort of sense of, I can't tell you what the year really is because actually none of us know. And so that all the all the years that are being used and are set are subject to discussion and debate, and we can only abide by what we have. But then he says, even if you look very carefully at what some of the medieval commentaries say, what Ibn Ezra, Bachya, all kinds of people, they're all giving slightly different figures for the essential years. And when you add them all up and you have to put them against the list of the high priests things just don't tally. And this all is related as well to a kind of a messianism that occurs all the time. So there was a messianic sort of fervor about the year 1575. Now, if you say there is no real year, we're not really in whatever it was, Shalah, actually, it's actually 100 years later, then you can't expect the Messiah in 1575. And so in a way, he is actually making a contemporary comment on his own historical situation, in a way telling people, don't be frightened, don't think that the Mashiach is coming, because he isn't, and any, because we're not in that year, whatever the case. So there is a kind of healthy skepticism that you find in his work. And he is not, I mean, continuously, of course, Maharal later attacked him. He keeps on saying, I wouldn't dream of saying anything which would contradict the rabbis of blessed memory, Zichrono Livracha, the whole time. And of course, he says that too often. And so you get a bit suspicious. Of course, he is contradicting them, but he's contradicting and not contradicting, because there isn't one view throughout the whole of the rabbinic corpus. And that's, I think, the main question. And in order to do this, of course, and what possibly upset people was that he was using not only Jewish sources, but of course non-Jewish sources, which he was familiar with, in order to show what the correct chronology of the time was. Is that clear? Is that?
I think it's clear, right? And like you're saying, he obviously, it wasn't, it, in some ways it does contradict Chazal, but he obviously claims that it went along with it. So what happened, obviously there was a big controversy that erupted, a cherem that erupted. So I guess talk about the controversy, the different rabbis that didn't like what he said, what they said to him, what he responded, and how the cherem, I guess try to how to put that all in one as much as easily we can.
Right, but before we get to that, let's go to the fourth part of the book, because we shouldn't forget it. You know, it's quite interesting that indeed is a third main part, and that's what people remember him for. But the fourth part is fascinating, because there he's talking about the big day kuhuna. And so De Rossi is a historian, and so he's looking at what do we know what the big day kuhuna looked like, what do they symbolize, and he goes for evidence, for those who actually were there. So Josephus, he was a priest, so his description must be correct. He goes to Philo, he goes to Aristeas, because after all the story takes place in Jerusalem, he actually sees them, and the beautiful description of the big day kuhuna. So there he does that, and he talks about, so what is it? And then he goes to the Mefarshim, the medieval Mefarshim, and tries to understand, so what did they actually look like? So there's what we call an antiquarian aspect to his research. He just wants to know what these things look like in order to sort of, for people to understand. So there's that aspect. Then he talks about the need to speak in favor, you know, the prayer for the realm that is said on Shabbat. And he talks about that. That's again somebody who is politically, historically aware of the world in which he's living. And the last section of the book is very interesting, because there you think of somebody who is a very critical thinker talking about the nature of Hebrew, the holy tongue, that it is the first language of the world. And then he talks about the Ta'amim and the Nukudot, and that they go back to Ezra at least. So here he's being very conservative in his position against Elijah Levita that I talked about before. And he ends on a very fascinating chapter, a very important chapter on the nature of biblical poetry. And we shouldn't forget that these are our pioneering studies of ancient history that are taken up by others later on. So we have to see the whole arc of the book and not only concentrate on that which became controversial, I think, because I'm sure nobody had any problem with him saying, well, biblical poetry doesn't have any meter, but it's, you know, there's a parallelism between the two parts of the verse and that kind of thing. And there he's following in Abravanel and people like that before him. He has had a sense of it, but he takes the subject of the nature of Hebrew poetry even further. So So he's a polymath. He's a polymathic scholar. We shouldn't forget that he isn't a controversialist. He's not out just to make machloket. So the controversy, there's controversy hovering, and you can see it from statements he makes in the book itself when he thinks that it's going to be problematic. And then it is. He has problems printing it. And then there's certain rabbis who, you remember that usually people have not read the book, but they club together and they say, this book shouldn't be read. It's always rumor. And that's always the case with anything that gets negative publicity. People latch onto it and they think, oh, this is not kosher. Let's forbid it, without really knowing what he's actually writing. And so certain rabbis come together. They say they draw up a ban in which they say only somebody over 25 who has permission from their rabbi in their locality may read it. And then he has to go to Venice to defend the book, and they insist that he make some changes, which he does. But as he says, it doesn't make any difference to the argument. He leaves out a few examples of the hyperbole that he makes, and then what? In addition, he has to have Moses Provençal's hasaga, his critique of the chronological part, put into the book. But then what does Rossi do? He produces a teshuvah, he responds. So in a way he gets the last word, which is very interesting. So you've got three printings of the book and that's it between 1573 and 1575. And what happens is that then the book is that it goes and people go over it, and they then retract any ban that might be being thought of. I don't think they would have called it a cherem. It wasn't called a cherem. That's too strong. But they retracted, and some even go as far as saying that he is a rabbi of the highest quality. But what happens as a result of that, what Roberto Bonfiglio has called a storm in a teacup. I think you've got another American expression, not a storm in a teacup or something else. I don't know what it is. But anyway, in England, we say storm in a teacup. Despite that, of course, the arguments, it has had its a pernicious effect, and there's a kind of controversy sort of hovers over it for even up to our own time. With certainly for people who haven't actually read it. So then of course there's the famous story of the Chida, now you have to realize the Chida is writing 200 years after de Rossi, more or less. And so in his Machazik Beracha, he's talking, and it's interesting the context, he's talking about what you may or may not read on Shabbat or during the week, what is allowed. And it's talking about historical books like the Shevet Yehuda or Ganzes Tzemach David and works of that kind. And then suddenly he says, and he draws out some document he found, and in that document it said that and a document sent by two disciples of Yosef Karo, who said that apparently before he died, he had wanted the book to be burnt. But as we discussed earlier on, it's not quite clear at all whether Karo actually read the book, whether he actually saw it. We don't know about the authenticity of the text. There was a text, and we know that it seems to have, there was a document found with that text on it, but we actually really do not know the force of it. And I think there is a bit of mystery over this, that somehow you're getting the name of Karo brought into something which probably doesn't belong there. But having said that, I have to admit that in a passage in De Rossi's Matsref la Kesef, which is a book he wrote, which wasn't published until the 19th century, which is a kind of, again, going back to the chronology calendrical thesis, he says at one point that those people in the Ottoman Empire, those people especially in Safat and in Fez, as soon as they get a sniff of it, they turn their back. And this could certainly be a reference to the Cairo incident, whatever it is. But we don't know. We just don't know. And so certainly we can understand that in certain very traditionalist circles, this book was felt as rather challenging. Yeah. Is that sufficient and clear?
I believe so. And I mentioned to you before we started recording, Meir Benio, the famous historian, has a extensive article on this in his journal, Asufot, volume 5, I believe. And I believe it's reproduced. You can see the picture of that text. The Chidah says, I think that the Ramesha Al-Sheikh, the Al-Sheikh, and the Relisha Galiko, students of the Reyes of Cairo, he told them to send the Kherims. But like you said, it only came from there. The question is also, I saw somewhere, I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong on this, did De Rossi work on the Reyes of Cairo's Kesef Mishnah? Was he an editor on that? Did he have some relationship with
it? Yeah, that's the marvelous thing, was that he helped to fund the publication. So he helped to, he gave money for the publication of the Kesef Mishnah. So that's this kind of irony there, that he's giving money for the publication of Cairo's work, and then I do think that the thing is, I'm not denying that something was said, and that there was controversy over it and fear of it. But what I'm saying, I think, is that it's not clear how things went. And it's quite interesting that for the Italian communities, the ban was lifted, and in a sense that for those who wanted to read it, it was the end of the story. For those who were going to be affected by what we're going to talk about later, Maharal's attack, then the attack would go on. That's what happens. So that the defenders and the attackers are the ones who just read for their own edification, I would say. Yeah,
absolutely. So now I think we should go there. What about the Maharal's critique, and what of that?
Right. So one thing I wanted to say, and I forgot to say about the Chidah, because he's so interesting, of course, the Chidah. He publishes that document. But what about himself? Who was he? You know, when he goes in his travelogue, it's a really fascinating text, and he's in the house of Jacob Saraval. He's the one who translated Avot into Italian. And he's in his library, and Saraval shows him a Christian Mishnah, that is the Latin translation of the Mishnah published by somebody called Surinusius at the end of the 17th century in Amsterdam, which contained Latin translations of the Hebrew text, the Mishnah, Latin translation of Bertinura and Rambam, and usually two Latin commentators, two Christian commentators on the same Masechet, plus amazing illustrations that went that were accompanying the book. So think of this. So that's a book that's very much product of Christians, and there is Chidah going to the Saraval's home and seeing the Surinusius sitting there and very interested in it, not saying, oh, this is Christian, what do we Jews have to do with it, but rather absolutely fascinated by it. And I think that this gives us some kind of puts into perspective that document that he is publishing there in what is a code. You know, there is a difference between what you write in a code and what you write when you're actually open to whatever you're reading and studying. It's very different. So a different, and we'll find out that there's a different dimension also with the Maharal. So Maharal, about 13 years after de Rossi published his Ma'ore Naim, he publishes his Be'er HaGola, and in the sixth part, there is this devastating attack on de Rossi that goes on for pages in very Maharalian prose. And what makes it even more vindictive in a sense is that he'd never names de Rossi once. So by not mentioning the name of the person he's referring to, it makes it stronger. Yeah.
I believe them just interesting to note. I'm not just making a comment. I think when the Maharal also has an attack on Ablezer Ashkenazi, he also doesn't mention it by name as well, right? There's no, is that correct?
Yeah. I think so. And it's racist. Rambam, yes, but he also attacks Rambam. So don't let's forget. He says, I'm not attacking him, the author, the polluted author, but the one who published it. And then he goes to a full-scale attack on de Rossi. And my take on it is as follows. The Maharal was one of the most original thinkers of his time, most original interpreters of the Agadot. And he had his own method, his own vocabulary, to treat the Agadot, and you have to bear that in mind. It's a very powerful exegesis. And it's different from ones that went before it and ones that went after it. Maharal is an interpreter on his own. So that's very important to remember. What you also have to remember is that there's a whole history, as we said before, of interpretation of Agadot, which goes in all kinds of different directions. And it can be more rationalistic, can be using philosophical vocabulary, can be making it into metaphor. I mean, just think of Rambam. There are all kinds of different approaches. Now, de Rossi's approach, it's not so terribly innovational. You know, what is he doing? He's saying, when I look at the Midrashim, I come as a historian or as a scientist, I see what can be taken literally and what can't be. There's certain things you just cannot take literally. And the rabbis themselves didn't need you to take it literally. And the one famous example that Maharal goes to town on is the famous story, which is in Ukaim, in Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, and also different Midrashim, and in Gittin as well, of the story of Titus and the gnat that entered his nostril, and it all kinds of different versions of it, of course, and that finally, when they opened his brain, they found this pigeon weighing 2 liters, and its beak was of brass, and its claws were of iron, and the whole thing. And so de Rossi says, look, I went and looked at the historical sources, and I found out that Titus died of fever. And moreover, this can't be. And then he goes as a scientist, somebody who knows his sound of knowledge, that this can't happen scientifically speaking, this is impossible. But he says, this is the way the rabbis want to show that God destroys the most powerful of men by the smallest of his creatures. So it's let's take this metaphorically. This is the basic drift of this Agadah. This drives Maharal to crazy. That how dared de Rossi say that the rabbis didn't mean a gnat when they said a gnat, didn't mean a beak when they said a beak, and iron and brass or whatever it is, that they meant exactly what they meant. And he goes into a kind of exegesis, a typical exegesis that Maharal always undertakes, where he talks about things being the essence. And what we should also bear in mind is he's using philosophical vocabulary, Aristotelian philosophical vocabulary, which is actually the legacy of medieval Jewish philosophy, namely the idea of potentiality and actuality, of matter and form. And he's using those ideas in interpreting the Agadah. So he's basically saying that what we're talking about is not the material gnat, it's the essence of gnat. And what does, sorry, gnat, yeah. What does a gnat do? Not a gnat, yes, a gnat. Yeah. And what does he do? He claws his way and he bites, and he has to, there's this active power that he's exerting, and the stronger it is, the stronger you have to bite and claw. And so he's talking about something, it both has, it's talking about symbol, but he's also depriving the text of any, he's saying that there is something called the essence of the gnat, the essence of the claw, the essence of destruction, which is what Titus is, and that is how you have to interpret the text. In other words, the end, in the conclusion, he's not saying anything so different from De Rossi, but what he's saying is you mustn't divest the words of their essential meaning. Therefore, a gnat is a gnat, but it's not a material gnat, it's an essential gnat. So it's his own philosophical concept of existence in a way that you're dealing with. And when you interpret in that way, there is no way that you can come anywhere close to a historian or who is analyzing the text in the way De Rossi does. And there's nothing wrong with the way De Rossi does it. It's a way of interpreting the Agadot. As we see, there are multiple ways of interpreting the Agadot, and there's no one Agadah. So, and so that in a sense, they are proceeding on different levels of existence, or levels of interpretation, which can never agree. And yet they do agree on some other level. You see what I mean?
I think what's so interesting also, I went for the morale, is that, and then he obviously is, yeah, he has his opinion, and then he says, I think it should be burnt, and then we have, you know, his students, I mean, the Tosfos Yomtov and other students of his, I think even the Tzemach Tov, Rabbi Gans, I think, quote the Mari Naim. So I think that's part of the thing that's very interesting here.
Well, let me just stop with Mara before I get to the disciples, because I think what's important again. So, as I said, Maharal is a very special case, a special thinker and a special way of interpreting. But some years ago, I was presented with a Hebrew document, which was in, I don't know if you know what, Album Amicorum, one of those kind of texts which people used to write. I even had it at school, when people leave somewhere, then they put their name in it and they say some nice few words. It's called an Album Amicorum. And they a little poem or a little picture, so that the people have a something to remember them by. And there was an album of a very great scholar called Jacques Bongard, who was both a diplomat and a classical scholar. And what happened was he and his mate were in Prague, and they went to the Klois, Maharal's Klois, and they said, we want to learn Hebrew. I want to study Hebrew with his mate. And you know what the Maharal said? He said, come in. And he got one of his people in his own close retinue to teach them. And they stayed in the Klois for 3 months, and they were taught Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim, says the person who wrote the Hebrew document. And at the end of those 3 months, we were great friends, and we and wanted to put my name in his Album Amicorum. You have an amazing situation here, where you have the Maharal, who is famous for his attacks on anybody who teaches Torah to a goy, saying, "Come in, come and study," and not batting an eyelid, apparently. Moreover, when I discovered it, and I published on this, when I later worked on it, and I found that in fact Maharal himself, at a certain point when he was going back from Prague to Poznan, he stopped in a place called Görlitz. And there he met a famous astronomer, Bartolomeus Scultetus, in the Blue Inn in Görlitz. And there he taught him about astronomy and about the Jewish calendar, interestingly. And the same thing happened on his way back. 15 years later, he had the same discussion. So you see, we have to be careful with what we read. Who is the Maharal that we read who says, you know, damn be this person who talks about the rabbis in this way. And woe to you who teaches Torah to a goy. He's opening his own cloister. So reality and is not always, doesn't always come through so clearly. And the people you think are who they are, without having had that document, I would never have dreamt for one minute that that would have happened. And for me, it was a really, it was an education, you know, not to be so clear, not to be so sure of myself when I interpret a literary text that I really know what the person is saying, because there may be other aspects to this one same person. Now, indeed, the Maharal had either disciples or people who were close to him. And one of them, as you said, was David Gantz, who wrote the Tzemach David. And with the Tzemach David, you come back from De Rossi, who's a historical critical work, to the chronicle. So it's a chronicle in two parts with the so-called Jewish part and the so-called general history. But the two are certainly interlinked. And basically, I studied the Gantz very carefully. De Rossi shines through it throughout the work, and he's using even the same kind of rhetoric that De Rossi used. He's adopted. It's quite extraordinary the extent to which Gantz has taken him up. And although sometimes he tries to distance himself from De Rossi, he's clearly, in a way, going in the same direction, but sometimes withdraws, tries to take a more conservative position. But he's read him from beginning to end, indeed. And if you look at the Tosafot Yom Tov, of course, certainly not a pupil of Maharal, but very close to him. He quotes De Rossi perfectly openly in his book. And there are many examples if you look. So people, the book is circulating, it is being read, but it doesn't get reprinted, of course, until the Wissenschaft des Judentums in the 19th century, until when the science of Judaism comes up and you've got somebody like Sun Tzu says, Azaria de Rossi was the first Jew, Jewish scholar to distinguish between truth and falsehood. So then he comes into his own, and scholars like him are able to appreciate the amazing pioneering work that he did.
So like you said about the Maharal, I mean, it's you know, these people did quote it. Maybe he just was trying to, you know, say using such strong words. He wanted to make sure that no one really read it. He obviously had some Rabbanim were reading it. I don't know. I'm not one to say. And one about the Chidah as well that's interesting is that I think in his Shem HaGdolim, which is his famous, you know, history work, so to speak, he doesn't mention Azariah de Rossi or Amar Einayim. So clearly he, you know, didn't like him, whatever that's worth. Just, you know, I'm not saying, and he, you know, he did say, like I said, and about the, anyone wants to see the cheirim that he found, it is in, Benayo has it in the article, it is reproduced. So are there any other famous works or Rabbanim that quote, that you do know that do quote Arinayim and De Rossi?
Well, it depends. You mean sort of in a traditionalist sense? Because I suppose you think Manasseh ben Israel and people like that are not.
Manasseh, on the
you know the necessary reading. In fact, so people like Manasseh ben Israel. I used to have a whole list of them, but they are. I mean, I'm not saying that they are enormous number, but they are, he's being read. And the very fact, I think with the, let's go back to the Tosafot Yom Tov, the very fact that it's put into the Mishnah commentary there, it means that there's no fear of quoting and using, despite all the controversy. So there is an openness, that there's more openness than you think. I'm not underestimating the negativity, because that's there. I mean, when Emden says he's ma'aveh einayim, then indeed he's, but that's typical Emden. Emden is the most unpleasant critic you can possibly have. You don't want him to read your work because you'll get into trouble. I'm not underestimating the negativity, but I think the people who actually read it got a lot out of it, is what I'm saying. And that I, you know, because Derossi wasn't a philosopher, he wasn't an exegete, he didn't have a lasting impact. But he was a historian. He didn't have a philosophy of history. He was a historian come antiquarian come polymath. And the people who really did appreciate his work were Christian scholars of the subsequent centuries. They saw his importance and the amount that he, the real contributions he made to understanding antiquity, and particularly Jewish antiquity, you see. And so for anybody with any sense of historical sense, Derossi is sort of absolutely important reading. Joseph Del Medico also said he was one of the important authors whose work should be read.
I think people may be familiar with him as Yasher Mikandia. I wanted to point out Rabbi Yaakov Emden, first of all, I told this to you before we recorded, that there's a Sefer Emes Liakiv, which has his stuff on Kabbalah and other notes that he wrote on Meir Mechai and others, and it does have his notes. It was published a few years ago on Mari Naim. About Mari Naim, before we get to that, I wanted to ask you just final off, why would someone want to read it? But before that, so we mentioned the Castle edition of Mari Naim is available in Hebrew books, and anyone can print it out in a hard copy if they want. And for English, there's your complete translation. So I just wanted to touch on that a little bit. I mean, we gave a full, I think, discussion of the book and a biography. Is that, how was that for you working on that? And, why did you decide to translate this massive work? I mean, your published book is pretty large.
I tell you, I regretted it many times. I regretted it many times. It was actually a fiendishly difficult thing to undertake. The reason why I undertook it was, in a way, I had to go back to my earliest education, to my classics, and to Arnaldo Momigliano, and to the interest when cultures come together, and the idea that, you know, no one culture is hermetically sealed, and the importance of recognizing the influences of others into your world, and how that actually also shapes your world. And so the Greco-Roman world had its impact on the rabbinic world, and the Islamic world had an impact on medieval Jews living in Islamic countries, and so on. You can go on. I'm talking in a very general way. And so when I was confronted with this work, about which I knew nothing, it was a big jump from antiquity to Renaissance Italy, to 16th century Italy. It was an enormous jump for me. I was very young. I was excited by the challenge of reading a work that was interested in Jewish antiquity, and using it and being able to confront the permeability of borders, that that Latin sources and Christian sources were relevant for reading Jewish sources as Jewish sources were relevant for Christian sources. Because one thing De Rossi does, he shows how important certain knowledge of Hebrew sources is for understanding Christian antiquity. So he is a kind of mediator between those two worlds. And that's what really attracted me to it. It was a really difficult thing to undertake because it's very difficult Hebrew. As I was said before, the sentences are enormously long. And that's probably the influence of his reading of Latin and Italian of the time. And of course, he has so many sources that he on a page. I mean, it's frightening. And one thing we should remember, which is quite interesting, is he uses hundreds of sources. But on the page, the main sources are rabbinic ones, especially the Talmud. He never quotes the Talmud by name because in the period in which he's living, he weren't allowed to refer to the Talmud. So he only refers to Gemara or to a Perek. But he knew his Talmud backwards and forwards. And sometimes he's quoting by heart, that's quite clear. But because although when the Talmud was burnt in 1553, there weren't so many copies circulating, they were indeed circulating, but probably often they were using other means to get to the text. So having to cope with all of the rabbinic world, all of the medieval world, I mean, everything that had been written until his own time. And he was reading not only all the many printed books, many, many Hebrew printed books by that time, but also manuscripts and comparing manuscripts. But he was also reading the classical, the pagan works, which he was reading in Latin translation. He was reading the classics of Christian world, so the patristic works of Jerome, Eusebius. He was reading Aquinas. He was reading medieval Jewish philosophy. He was reading Kabbalah. He knew the Kabbalistic texts. Remember, he had a copy both of the Mantuan and Cremona edition of the Zohar. I mean, he had obviously an amazing library, and of course also went to look at books in other people's homes. It was extraordinary how much he had access to. So the difficulties was, it was an education for me, basically. So I had to go and read all the texts that he read, and that educated me. And that I'm very thankful for that. But it was a long journey, but a worthwhile one, I think. Yeah.
Okay, so the last question, I think there's still plenty more to talk about. As long as we've gone, there's still much more to talk about, Mari and I. But I think the last question I really would say is, how would you say it's relevant for someone today? Is it worth, is it worth somebody, for someone to read it today?
Right. Well, it depends who that somebody is, obviously. I wouldn't advise everybody to read it. I think, of course, if you at all have any scholarly interests and interesting in reading a classic, because I think it is a classic, a Jewish classic, that can sit very proudly with Sfornos Ha'amim, or let me think what else, Yehuda Halevi's Kuzari. It's a classic work in its own right as the first critical historical work of Jewish history. In that sense, I think it's worthwhile for scholars who are interested in good scholarship and to understand what a Jew living in late 16th century, not easy time. After the destruction of the Talmud, in a time of censorship, in a time of Mantua and Ferrara, there are no ghettos yet, but there was of course ghetto in Rome, ghetto in Venice, but not in Mantua and Ferrara when he was living. But it was a not easy times, and to have that excess, one might say, of scholarship. In so many different areas, you can learn if you're interested in poetry. It's amazing what he was able to do single-handedly. So I think indeed it is worthwhile if you're if you're prepared to sort of trudge through a lot of detail and arguments that go over and over and a lot of sort of bringing citations when one would suffice, he brings 10 or something like that. So I do think it's worthwhile, but obviously not for everybody. It's not a novel. It's not light reading.